how to describe it. It's like every single trend and vertical of decarbonization and what's happened in the past and what's about to happen.
You'll need more final energy for a net zero world. You'll need a lot more electrons, not just what people produce, but what people consume, not just what is burned, but what is actually used. But we're at a moment where you can see these things peaking, and then all sorts of questions begin to emerge.
But anyway, that's not a very good argument, right? What we need to do, really, is use a lot less of these minerals.
Job, and the fundamental job is not a particular battery chemistry. The fundamental job is the cost of stored electrons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Modo, the podcast. Today's guest needs little introducing. We are joined by Nat Bullard. Nat is an independent analyst, company advisor, senior contributor at Bloomberg NEF, and holds many other roles as well. Today, we are taking a look at the state of climate and decarbonization. As always, if you're enjoying the podcast, please hit like and subscribe. It really means the world to us. Let's jump in.
Nat, I've got to start with the slides. 137 slides, and you give them all away for free. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
So, I think there's a long history, in a good way, of people trying to make sense of a complex sector that's made up out of various subsectors, or a sort of new kind of mega trend composed of subsidiary big trends of their own. You know, I would say this began with sort of most famously with Mary Meeker, the investment banker and now venture capital investor, who began in the 90s with a presentation simply called Internet Trends. And she, to the great benefit of anybody who's an historian of PowerPoint presentations, has got all of them still public going back to the mid 90s. And it's just been called, as I said, Internet Trends. That's it. And it sort of sought to define, circumscribe this world that was becoming the internet. And that arose, I think, because you had separate domains that themselves lived within sort of financial analysis and technical verticals. You had networks, you had communications equipment, you had telcos, you had media. And I think her vision was actually all of these things are interrelated and they're all feeding off of and into each other. And that expanded in remit until it was like 400 slides almost at one point. And that was, I think, a great model for myself, certainly for others who do this better than I do. Benedict Evans would be a very trenchant example in the UK who does this covering technology. And I realized that there was sort of no one covering that in climate. And I spent 15 years full time with Bloomberg NEF and its predecessor company, the old New Energy Finance. And what you find is you become increasingly specialized and increasingly domain bound. That's a feature, not a bug, of the syndicated research service. You find yourself more and more tucked into particular places because you need more technical aptitude. You need more understanding of specific market conditions or geographies. But, you know, the megatrend just keeps getting bigger and bigger. It goes from $50 billion of investment to $1.1 trillion in less than two decades. And it starts to, as tech did back in the day, become its own theme. So decarbonization is a combination of industrial transformation, power sector, transport, industry, food, and agriculture, plus the interaction of the climate system, plus the interaction of financial markets and capital markets. And the part that I'm particularly interested in is business cycles and business creation and formation, which I'm sure that you and your audience are interested in as well. And so I guess the short one sentence answer of why all of this is that we talk all the time about businesses in climate, but not the business of climate itself. What is the business of decarbonization? How does one create a company that has enduring value and competitive advantage? How do you create moats and defensible businesses? And how do you make money in particular in areas wherein the physics sort of mitigates in favor of things being a cost forever? I'm thinking in particular here of anything related to capturing carbon. You know, another way to put it is that, you know, we're sort of at the end of the beginning, to go sort of Churchillian about it, in terms of what we've been able to figure out technologically, financially, capably in terms of doing to decarbonize. We're about 10% of the electricity sector, now about 12% decarbonized, about 10% EV sales. The right kind of S-curve shapes for things like deploying batteries, solar, and wind. The right, I think the sort of right fractal version of a trajectory in terms of investing in energy transition and infrastructure, but also at the early stage in private companies. But like we've got 90% left to go if you actually want to get this all the way to net zero. And thinking about that insofar as possible as a whole, I thought was useful. And hopefully, as I'm building next year's, using just decarbonization as the lens, the same way that Mary Meeker said, internet trends. Like, what are the trends in internet? I would like to know what are the trends in decarbonization, as opposed to the properly siloed, what are the trends in transport? What is the trend in industry? What is the trend in the power sector? What is the trend in the capital markets? And it's hard to pull together, frankly. I would joke that like it's so difficult to do that you can only do it on your own. Like I think if I sort of tasked a big team at the moment with doing it, we would end up with like tightly bounded areas that sort of communicate internally very well, but don't communicate externally very well. So I'm looking for the same kind of markers, the same sort of patterns, the same inflection points, the same moments of inception across all these different sectors.
And so for us, I mean, I've been a big fan of your work for a long time, probably half a decade. And for many of us listening and folks of us at Modo, we know you from Twitter and the Bloomberg days. Some incredible content came out from you and your team back then. And of course, friend of the podcast, Michael Liebreich. You used to work with Michael back in the NEF days when there was very few people really talking about climate and where the money flows are. So could you just talk for a minute before we get into the detail? I want to know what's it been like over the last 15 or so years for you, your journey with Bloomberg, NEF, then Bloomberg, and now on your own. What have those chapters look like and what have you noticed?
So the chapter begins with finishing my undergraduate, going to work in Egypt and teaching for an American school. And sort of getting this sense for what it's like at the sort of the front end of a big developing country and how integral energy access was to a population like that. Egypt was very highly electrified, but the differences in what people had between different aspects of the country and the culture were really striking. And I then went back to graduate school after a couple of years of other work and started to study energy in this sort of early nascent way of like holistically with like energy policy, energy economics, trade flows, and a little bit about technology. This is 2004. So this is the year that the German feed-in tariff is introduced. And it's also when you start to get liquidity in enough markets that you can look at them. And I graduated 2006 into this landscape in which Michael had already built a company, fortuitously enough, it started in 2004. But looking for people who had any sort of expertise in this was very, very thin. And I think despite what Michael would probably still tell you was a desultory and unimpressive undergraduate and graduate educational experience, I was one of the few people that had actually studied any of these things now. And this is, I would love to know the history of like Imperial's Energy Futures program. As far as I recall, it wasn't even around at that time that I was graduating. I'm probably wrong, but it was unusual for somebody to come in with an experience that looked like this already academically, even if it was not at all yet informed by anything in the market. I'd at least done that study and was able to enter a sector, I think, in a way that would be very hard to do today, if I'm candid, at least at the level that I did, where you're like, okay, show up, and 8 months later, you're going to be the US solar analyst because, well, there's now a solar market and we need an analyst to cover it. It was either that or the wind sector, but I think the wind was already a little bit better understood and a little bit better covered. So, we enter this sort of first age where it's very much, especially in the United States, just about renewable energy. It's just covering what's happening in wind, solar, in the US, in first generation, and the never yet really emerged second generation biofuels, and some very, very early compliance type markets for carbon. Europe is obviously different. You've got all those things, plus an actual real carbon market. And then, that took us through, a financial crisis, a fair amount of government support coming around the world. I think we used to do the numbers and it was around $70 billion. Sounds very quaint today, but of support for subsidies
only
for clean energy coming
dollars.
Out of the financial crisis. And that sort of carried through to the point where we happened to get acquired by Bloomberg, which Michael could tell you about and did tell you about in great detail. And you also sort of start to have this transition at that point into a couple of years of being sort of range bound in total investment, improvements in technology, capital continuing to flow, but you also start to get the strategic shift where people begin talking about energy transition. You know, this idea that you're going to move beyond just covering one little, you know, one particular sector with a special situations group and principal investors doing all the capital, into maybe an entire team stood up within a big organization that's going to focus on ring fencing your decarbonization to, like, well, this one part of the company, we can get to net zero by 2050 or whatever. And a lot of, frankly, divestment, which is not really a way of decarbonizing at all. That's a sort of balance sheet jiggery pokery to decarbonize by making it somebody else's problem. And then that takes us through, you know, $500 billion more these days, closer to, you know, I would say through last year, close to $1 trillion or so of investment. And now we're entering a sort of a new era where what we are all talking about, and rightly so, I think, is reaching net zero by the middle of the century. And that means, first of all, you have to do everything. There's no sector that you can't cover. If you're a big international company, there's no way that you can just leave something uncovered. It means making hard decisions, not just around electricity or transportation, but around chemistry, around molecules, around removing things from the atmosphere, and requires a scale of capital commitment that's like five times bigger or six times bigger than that. And also, it's going to be really hard to do. You know, as I said, we're sort of end of the beginning period now. And I feel like the era that we're in is like looking at the last exponent between 10% and 100% is neat. It's nifty. Rhetorically, it sounds like the next move, but it's going to be so difficult and it's going to require so much money and so much time. But it is also therefore so interesting because if we think about this from an Overton window perspective, this is now well within the Overton window that respectable people talk about this, as opposed to it being, you know, academic studies stuff or something from a think tank. It's well within what companies themselves have said is going to be their expectation on business in the long run.
So I want to get straight into asking some energy-related questions.
Sure.
And the first one is very, very basic, but no one knows this stuff like you do. So the state of CO2 levels at the moment, how bad is it?
Well, bad. I mean, it's like the highest, depending on which sort of level of science you want. It's either the highest in 800,000 years or in 3 million years. Depends if you want to model something, if you want to just pull ice cores. It's sort of immaterial to me how, like the specific level, it's the trajectory, which if you try to chart it over that time, it's just like years of sort of like wobbling around a mean. And then this like vertical line that gets us to where we are today. You know, we can track it back probably, you know, at this point, close to 300 years. You know, if we want to go back to the days of purpose-built industrial extraction and transformation of crustal carbon of one form or another into atmospheric carbon. And yeah, we're way above 400 parts per million. I think we're above 420 parts per million at the moment. We don't really seem to be on a trajectory that's changing that. And it's at a level where we're starting to feel its impacts in the atmosphere. And I think, I don't know about you, but I rarely have discussions anymore where people doubt or impugn the science of the carbon dioxide itself. I'll give a little frame on this. When I was starting this work, you know, 15 years ago, one of the key NGOs that was talking about keeping us to within what they defined as planetary boundaries around carbon dioxide levels was 350. Right, 350 parts per million was like the thing that we were meant to be hitting. And we're like 20% over that at the moment. And we're not necessarily going to go to like 700 parts per million of carbon dioxide. You know, we're not on our way necessarily to becoming Venus. But we're in a position where we've kind of blown past all of the other nominal points that we were meant to hit along the way to sort of make our temperatures easily managed. You know, you can read the sort of thought experiments. What if we'd begun this decarbonization in the 90s? Or what if we had sort of maintained the momentum that was happening in the early 80s coming out of oil crises and with the levels of R&D we had? They're interesting. They're a bit morose if we look at them. they're also irrelevant in that, like, you know, we can't unring the bell that we've rung so far. I would also add that we have, you know, we've got rising methane levels as well. I think a lot of that, honestly, is probably we're getting greater granularity on measuring it. We're sort of realizing that it's both a problem and an addressable market, so to speak, in the interim. And it's also something that I think people will view as a business opportunity to mitigate and to abate. We've got I can't recall exactly where our chlorofluorocarbon levels are, but like we have other things that have radiative forcing impacts on the Earth. And yeah, the short answer is like bad, and not any time in human history has it been like this in terms of level or in terms of vector.
So that sets the stage for this. And your most recent piece of work, which I would recommend that everybody listen to this, go straight online and downloads, which is how to describe it? It's like every single trend and vertical of decarbonization and what's happened in the past and what's about to happen. We're going to talk about that a lot today, but we've covered the why are we even here? Why are we even talking about decarbonization? I'm going to ask a bit of a silly question here, and I'm interested to know what your thoughts are. Conventional wisdom is that the world needs growth and growth needs emissions, right? And emissions and growth are intrinsically linked, or I think that they have been until now. How are we going to have the growth that we need to get the, you know, the billions of people out of poverty and all the socioeconomic improvements that the world needs in hopefully a fair or fairish way without the emissions? Is that possible?
Well, so what I find fascinating about these discussions is that it's as though our economic growth required emissions with no energetic input. It's as if somebody was like, in order to grow, I just need to emit carbon dioxide, which is baloney. Like the actual thing that we do is consume primary and final energy. And the problem is there's a fairly intense correlation throughout industrial human history between primary energy, fossil fuel combustion, and therefore emissions. And so the challenge is to not consume less energy. I'm aligned with you on this one. I think that that's not a sort of great way to envision the future, in particular because decarbonization itself requires an extraordinary amount of energy. Probably, if we want to reach net zero, three times as much electricity as we generate today by the middle of the century.
Wow. That's
worth so, you know, going from 25,000 to 75,000 terawatt hours. But in so doing, decarbonizing that process of electricity and using that decarbonized electricity to decarbonize other things. So I feel like this is true as you look backwards, but it doesn't need to be predictive. And it's also not honestly an accurate description of the equation, in the sense that like that's the waste part of the equation. That's not the benefit part of the equation. The benefit part of the equation is energy supply to do stuff, the ability to do work. And it just so happens that for a very long time, that has required burning stuff. And one of the fascinating outputs of looking at the modeling that the BNEF team has done for a net zero future is that it actually uses less primary energy than the energy transition scenario.
Because what do you mean by primary energy? Nah.
So primary energy is the energy contained, that's generally speaking, it's like the energy contained in the fuel itself, right? Like how much of this is, you know, how much is the energy content in a ton of coal, you know, in a billion cubic meters of natural gas? And obviously most of that as you burn things is simply expressed as waste heat. You know, the maximum thermal efficiencies we have are generally in the 30 to 40% range, meaning that a lot of what we have been doing in our industrial history is simply creating heat and as a byproduct, creating work as opposed to the other way around. Whereas if you are to use renewably generated electricity, which is already a final product, you know, like it's ready to be used. It doesn't need another transformation. And you put it into, say, a storage battery and an electric motor for motive power, you've suddenly got this much more efficient way to energize the system. And this is something that it's very simple, I think, if you're a scientist. It's not so simple if you're anybody else and you're not attuned to the way that this works. But I think that this is a very important way of thinking about it, is that you end up doing, you'll need more final energy for a net zero world. You'll need a lot more electrons. You'll need more renewable molecules and things like that too, of course. But you'll need less primary energy. You'll be consuming less of the stuff that you dig up and burn. And like, it's a fascinating outcome to think about. But it's part of what gives me hope that we can find ourselves on a path to do this. But really, this is a cognitive thing. This is a challenge if you've been in the business of digging up stuff and burning it, to think that like you need to move from the primary side of the ledger to the final side of the ledger. Not just what people produce, but what people consume. Not just what is burned, but what is actually used. And so I do think that we should look to a future that has more final energy, less primary energy, more energy for all people, more electricity, that provides the toolkit to decarbonize all that we have today and to allow people to energize their world to the extent possible, to the degree possible, with something that has no emissions and that has much fewer losses along the way.
Nat, you've been looking in the business of following the money for quite a long time now. So can we just talk about that for a second? Where's the money going? If we had to talk basically about, in basic terms, about is it going into renewables or is it going into fossil stuff or is it going into abatement and carbon capture? Where's the money going to at the moment?
It's a good question. So I'll use BNEF's figures here. So last year, about 50-50, $1.1 trillion, and almost an exact split within that of going towards electrified transport, which is almost entirely vehicles, but some infrastructure, and renewable power generation. I think this is a fantastic competition to kick off, by the way, between two sectors to see which one is going to invest more quickest. But combined, I recall $1.1 trillion, of which about, you know, like close to $500 billion is coming from each of those. They're okay. Very, very close. And then the remainder is
2022.
Last year, 2022. And last year is other stuff. It's, you know, you've got a 10% bumper that's left over for carbon capture, for hydrogen, for energy efficiency, for some storage on the grid. The IEA will give you different figures, directionally the same, but they just add other things into that mix. So it's really interesting because, you know, a few years ago in the electric vehicle side of that chart would have been nil or close to nothing. So you're now seeing these things to sort of grow in scale alongside each other. The fastest growing part is EVs. As I recall, the smallest amount of investment is going to hydrogen, but it was the fastest growing. We have more investment going towards nuclear, also going towards industrial applications and residential applications like heat pumps. But the bulk of the money is going to two big sectors and sort of like, if you want to put it one way, four technologies or three and a half technologies: wind, solar, storage batteries, and electric vehicles. But the EVs and the storage batteries, this is sort of each, one half of each other, if you will. And in the long run, BNEF's outlook for either scenario, for either the energy transition scenario, which doesn't get us to net zero emissions, or the net zero scenario, is that just under half of all of the investment will be in electric vehicles. And another couple of percent is going towards things that we would say would be on the demand side. So in particular, things like heat pumps. And that's kind of fascinating because you find yourself in a long-term future where the drivers of capital investment are happening more on the demand side than on the supply side, which is very different from the past 15 to 20 years. And where we can start to think about interesting new levers to inform the growth trajectory. Like, let's put it this way. We individuals make different buying decisions about cars than RWE and National Grid make about buying power generation assets. So we've got new tools in the demand side of the ledger to be utilized in thinking about a deep decarbonization.
And how does that compare to investment in fossil fuel things?
So fossils, more. Like depends. Again, BNEF numbers says about the same amount invested. In fact, almost down to the dollar last year.
So $1 trillion.
Fossil fuels and unabated oil and gas production and unabated power generation. So $1.1 trillion. IEA's figures, which include other things, actually says that for about the last 5 years, there's been more investment in the renewable side of things, including hydrogen, or the zero carbon side of things, including hydrogen, nuclear, efficiency, and grids, than there has been in fossil fuels. The IEA also says that this year we will have more money invested in solar than in upstream oil production, which is worth noting, I think. Seems a bit, first of a kind comps like this are always kind of cheeky. Like, that's the best way to think about them.
Yeah.
The question is, what's the vector behind that? But it's interesting to see. I think related to that, something that is not inherent in those figures, but is important to note, is that we collectively in the world are well below historical levels of fossil, of oil and gas capital expenditure. like from the last time that oil was $100 a barrel, we're down multiple $100 billion a year of capital expenditure. And it looks not exactly range bound, but it doesn't look to be heading at the moment into another capital investment super cycle, which is intriguing. I still think it's early days of kind of figuring out all of the interplays here. But, you know, if you'd gone back to March 2022, having watched what oil prices were doing and then said to somebody, well, they're going to be trading below where they were, I think people would be quite surprised. You know, we're starting to reach the point where there are levers to inflect the demand trajectory for oil, in particular in road transport. It is, you know, it is a global good priced on the margin. So as you start to shave off the top, like you start to sort of compress the marginal curve, there are some molecules. You know, coal is at an all time high, and so for that matter is natural gas. If you look at the trends, it doesn't look likely that any time in the next like 10 years we're probably going to hit the peak of natural gas consumption. But certainly IEA, but others like RMI would suggest that we're close to the peak consumption for all fossil fuels, and within that, at or very near for oil and for coal in particular. I think the biggest challenge for coal is that the single largest consumer makes its own internally ring-fenced decisions about coal production that have national security reasons behind them, but also have reasons such as drought behind them. You know, that was the spike in coal consumption in China last year is largely because they had trouble with hydro production and it was extremely hot. So you have things that you can't really model out of the very long run and expect to come true in the very near term. As I recall, China's peak demand, it sort of gap up in peak demand incidence from 2021 to 2022 was about the same as Germany's entire power generation fleet at peak capacity.
Wow.
It was somewhere around 200 gigawatts. So when that is your delta that you're playing in, small moves relatively can actually have fairly large absolute implications. But we're at a moment where you can see these things peaking, and then all sorts of questions begin to emerge. That's really challenging if you're in a capital investment scenario. What do you invest for? You know, if you think about investing in the last the oil and gas supercycle that was certainly before the financial crisis, and then again, briefly through about 2014 afterwards, you were on the assumption that like this is a monotonically increasing demand function with the exception of global economic meltdowns. I'm going to invest so that I stay ahead of that. If you find the scenario being more than like, well, we're either range bound in terms of total consumption or it's going to begin to decline, investment strategies have to change because now you're no longer chasing the marginal barrel, you're chasing the marginal cost. You're trying to get to places where you are producing at the lowest possible cost instead of producing in the greatest possible volume. And you start to have other imperatives. I think the strategic imperative for the global super majors and definitely for the independents here in the US has been to de-lever and get yourself to, you know, a break-even cost that's as low as possible. And that leads to interesting implications where you can produce less and return more money to shareholders, which after burning through more than $100 billion of shareholder money in the US shale patch, investors are delighted to have happen. So you've got strategic imperatives that I think will be changing and are, and I say this in the most honest way, are really challenging to think about if that has not been the basis for an executive's training in the sector and for the sector's own self-education as far as what you can expect of coupling economic growth with total GDP equals this much oil, gas, and coal. Maybe you do some switches on the margin between, you know, from oil and power generation to coal, which is what happened in the 1970s in the US, and then to gas instead of coal and power and industry, which is happening around the world. Oil still goes on because of cars and petrochemicals. But thinking about how this is all going to work if they all reach a peak is legitimately challenging. And to be fair, I think it's also hard to do because it's not in anybody's strategic framework because it never had to be in anybody's strategic framework.
And what about the additional spanners in the works right now? So the cost of capital is double digits.
Yeah.
We've got war in Europe. There's a lot happening that it sets some of these models off in very odd directions. So it does. How do those things impact this?
So it's funny, you know what it sets off to my mind more than the models is it sets off the talking points. If you go to a big energy conference, what you will hear is not so much today, but certainly 9 months ago, you would hear like, well, supply chain issues, inflation, war in Ukraine. They have clearly shown us that like the energy transition is not on track, except that this is complete nonsense because it's like an almost data-free assertion. I was like, well, wait a minute. We had record installations of solar. We had record new power generation coming from wind and solar last year. Europe, continental Europe in particular, jumped forward its energy decarbonization trajectory by like maybe a decade because of quick decisions that have been made. Industrial policy has leapt to the fore in a way that it hasn't in decades. EVs are more than 10% of sales. EVs are displacing 1.5 million barrels of oil demand every day. The incremental additional power generation from wind and solar last year is about what France generates in a year. I'm like, I don't know what other signals people are looking for to show that it is working versus not working. It does certainly inflect the way that people think about supply for hydrocarbons. But leaving that aside, talking about the money element, is that yes, the cost of capital for assets that are highly levered and have a levelized cost informed almost exclusively by capital expenditure and not operating expenditure is a thing, except at least on a levelized basis, the marginal unit is still cheaper from wind or solar than from coal or gas, in particular in Europe. And we see no substantive pulling back in any of these investment trends. And so it's really interesting to see. I think what has been also fascinating, and something I wrote about actually just published last week, just a day before we're recording now, was what it has done to the internal strategies of the super majors in particular in their thinking about investment. So we're starting to see a little bit of pullback in how the five biggest international oil companies and publicly traded oil companies are treating energy transition. This is a challenge for them, frankly. I said this in a neutral way. You're going to have a sort of structurally lower return on your levered or unlevered renewable assets compared to today's investments in upstream oil or gas. Now, that was fine when they were sort of aligned. It was easier pitch to say that you're going to decarbonize, but you do have shareholders. And so we've seen some sort of rebalancing and sort of portfolio expectations in terms of what companies were going to do. Oil companies have gone from $3.2 to about $32 billion worth of energy transition CapEx since 2015 to last year. It's gone from 0.8 to about 8.6% of their total CapEx within the super majors going towards, or the majors in general, going towards energy transition. But what's interesting is they've also gone from 0.8% of energy transition investment writ large towards less than 3% of total energy transition investment. So while this has become it's 10x internally in terms of what it means to the oil and gas companies, it's only about 3.5 to 4x within what it means for energy transition. Now, as some of my good friends who are running companies and particularly raising money have pointed out, the oil majors have played a disproportionate role in early stage financing, actually. That might be more material, their role in providing venture funding for a lot of these new companies than they have for asset-based financing. And I think that's important to note. And they also have commitments as limited partners into other people's funds. And it'll be interesting to see how those play out. Those are a little bit longer dated. Like, it's hard to probably pull back an LP commit, a limited partner commitment that you've made. Less difficult probably to wind down corporate venture capital fund. And we've seen one of the majors do this. Total did this recently. So we're at a place where, like, I think this is a bigger deal for the majors themselves than it is for energy transition. Like a rotation back towards hydrocarbon production and processing and away from renewables, particularly renewable power generation, means more for the oil companies than it does for the energy transition.
That's good to know. And so if we talk about renewables for a moment, what's the current state of renewables? We at Modo, we talk a lot about batteries and co-located assets, but what's the state of renewables in general? worldwide.
It's important to note that we have global markets, but we also have disproportionate shares of the developed markets in particular. And I think this is something we should be aware of, is that despite all the sort of benefits, the distributed benefits that come from solar, for instance, and how much that should be scattered around to places where the grid is thin or non-existent, where providing power on the margin could be really useful, most of the investment is happening in the developed markets where there's capital to provide. Probably going to do 350 gigawatts of solar this year installed, which sounds bananas to me as a former solar analyst. Like, I have to remember that. I have to remember that, you know, suspend my disbelief, so to speak, and trust in the compound annual growth rate. But we're on the way towards, let's see, at the moment, I think about more than 80% of marginal year-on-year electricity demand growth is being met by renewable power already. We're soon to be at the point where it's more than 100. And per the oil discussion we had just a moment ago, it's going to have very, very interesting implication when this becomes all, not just the only, you know, not just all of the growth, but then the only growth, and then forcing everything else, not, we can call it negative growth, but forcing them sort of out of global merit is going to be interesting. But I think what's also important is that there's, we can see in particular in batteries and in solar, if you look into the announced production, and not even that far out, the announced production in the next couple of years for production capacity for wind, for solar in particular, and for batteries, we're very close to, if not well above in solar's case, what you would need to produce for a net zero scenario. We sort of have to backfill that. Like the capacity has been announced, the factories need to be built, then they need to be operated. But the IEA has stated that even if you were to, build every solar module factory that's been announced today, and if you're to run them at the historically fairly desultory 40% capacity, you're still going to be producing like 600 gigawatts of PV modules a year. You're going to find yourself well within the frame of what's needed within that sector alone to reach net zero. So having watched solar long enough, like, disbelief suspension is an important part of the analyst's process. To sort of look at that and be like, stop disbelieving it, and just remember that every time you disbelieved it in the past, that happened anyways. You know, you can analyze it very carefully in terms of what the corporate strategy is, what the mindset is behind it, but it tends to go on. It's a highly distributed sector with highly distributed, highly competitive thinking. And just look ahead and say, like, listen, this is we're more likely than not to be able to hit this fairly easily. Like, if we wanted to do a terawatt of PV a year in a sector that has a high 20s compound growth rate, we need to double it one more time, and then we need to grow it another 50%. In a sector with like a 28%, you know, 25% compound growth rate, that doesn't require a lot of imagination to get there. And it's important to look at it and not assume a priori that there is some kind of limit to that happening. And I say that only because every other time it's happened, it's been pretty silly. it hasn't worked. You know, I have recollections, as I'm sure you do, from earlier days of a grid engineer who would swear up and down to you that you can never do more than 5% PV penetration in any grid. Right. Well, not to sound too much to Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, but, you know, life finds a way, right? And it finds a way because there is a business imperative to do so. You know, capacity once built wants to run. You know, products once produced want to be installed. Power, you know, assets once installed want to be energized. Energy once available wants to be consumed. And, you know, the cool thing is that I think we can take on faith that it's definitely within technical and financial feasibility to ship 700 gigawatts a year of PV modules. And then it's up to the market to decide what's going to happen with that. Like, what's the best use for it? And this is another thing that I think people sort of discount, is that if you manufacture, your job is to manufacture a product and to a healthy extent, allow the market to determine where that is meant to go. Now, we've seen in the solar sector in particular over time, there are some periods in which companies internalize that decision to say, I'm going to go develop assets. I'm going to become a greenfield developer of assets using my own material. But still, the bulk of what happens is that a product is made and sold, and it goes into the market, and the market and market participants determine what to do with it.
We talked a lot about solar there. What about batteries? What's your view on the impact that they're going to have? And
so I'm not as informed on batteries as I'm on solar. As you can tell, it's once a solar analyst, always. What I follow is that first, it's mapping to a very established trajectory in the same way that solar was. Second, we've had near-term impact from the commodities and the cost of capital inputs to it. You know, in last year, the price of EV of batteries at the index level ticked up a little bit. What I'm excited about, and I should probably throw this question back to you, is what's coming in terms of diversifying the technological capability. And this is where I want to sort of question my own priors on solar. So bear with me, another solar analogy, but like what we saw in solar is that like you got 1,000 new solar semiconductors bloom and they all withered and died with the exception of one besides crystalline silicon. It was just hard to make a differentiation between them when the prime determinant of value was cost and then the cost of energy that came out of it. With batteries though, I'm super interested to see what happens in terms of moving from, you know, we've had one trajectory towards sort of the ever greater efficiency and energy density of today's high performance lithium ion batteries. But we're starting to see sort of competing trajectories from lithium iron phosphate, LFP batteries, which is, if I recall correctly, were 62% of all EV batteries in China by volume last year. And then coming behind that, sodium ion batteries, which we're starting to see enter the wild through promised production on the part of major manufacturers. I think this is going to be really cool because it's a case where you can see differentiation in performance. You know, maybe you have lower efficiency, but you also have much lower cost. So that allows a differentiation in terms of where these battery chemistries are going to be deployed. I would love to see grid install batteries at scale and at volume that are different than what we have today, as well as eventually moving into the sort of the longer duration, let's say multiple days of storage where that's needed. Again, what I think is exciting and healthy here is that this competition will happen in the daylight. It will happen with competitive tenders and RFPs. It will happen with manufacturers, engineers, quality controllers, bankers looking very carefully at what's there and saying, I think this is going to fit. And, you know, let's let the competition happen. But I'm going to put it back to you, and I want you to tell me, like, what do you think as you look ahead on the battery universe?
It's similar to solar, but it's quite different too, because you have different use cases. The solar use case is quite carbon copyable, but the use case for batteries are very different. I think the thing that always surprises me, and it doesn't get talked about enough, is there's a lot of naysayers around electric vehicles and batteries, and a lot of them suddenly have a huge moral compass around minerals, right? Which in itself is quite ironic. You know, if you're going to go and, you know, wear fast fashion and consume all the other minerals, then and all those other issues with the modern capitalist system, this is the one you have an issue with. But anyway, that's not a very good argument, right? What we need to do really is use a lot less of these minerals. And that's exactly what happens. If you look at the data, the amount of cobalt, which is used in the generation of lithium-ion cells we're looking at now compared to 10 years ago, is orders of magnitude less. I mean, the economics of these minerals and the supply chain, which nobody's happy with. It's not like there's some people on the earth, some people who are building battery cells, who are saying, yes, I love this supply chain. I want, you know, the Congo to be the single source for all of it. Nobody wants that. And so they're designing out these kind of minerals, but it just doesn't get talked about enough, I don't think.
It doesn't get talked about nearly enough. It is amazing how often, you know, that pops into the mentions, so to speak. They're like, well, what about this? I was like, would you like to talk about like what two centuries of hydrocarbon extraction has done? Like, come on now. I find these arguments mostly insincere. I think they actually are they're specifically much more important than they are generally important, if that makes sense. And I 1,000% support being like, look, this needs to be done as absolutely well as possible with the most attention to social justice, to equity, to pollution, to opportunity for everyone. It really does. But I think the sector itself is generally aligned with that. So I find most of the arguments against to be in very bad faith. And also very, to your point, very uninformed regarding the actual trajectories that are there. As you say, it's not like there's any beneficiary within the sector to high degrees of concentration and structural shortages. And that's where these highly distributed you know, high unit volume sectors are fantastic at finding new ways to do the fundamental job. And the fundamental job is not a particular battery chemistry. The fundamental job is the cost of stored electrons. That's it, right? Like, and there's some differentiation based on particular applications. But again, that will be determined in a very supple way in the market. Like, it's not like governments sit down and are going to be like, you know, here's our once every 5 year tender for batteries.
Like, yeah, exactly.
That's not going to happen, right? And they're never going to specify, you know, no government is going to specify, here's the chemistry that you're allowed to pitch us, and that's it. No, like it's well, a marvelous function of competition.
Yeah, never say never. You never know.
Yeah, well, I look forward to the cobalt working group, popping up at the EU that requires certain percentages. But, you know, by about the time that comes to bear, by about the time that that's out of committee, as we would say in the US, it will be irrelevant. The market will have moved past it.
As if there's some executive somewhere at Samsung SDI rubbing their hands together at the delight of having so much of their supply chain stuck in Africa. You know, it just doesn't make any sense, but whatever. I want to move on to something that is proprietary. I've heard you speak a few times now in lots of different settings, but particularly about a new framework that you have about, you call it the three ages of decarbonization.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how you're thinking there, what's the framework, and how you apply it?
So the framework was that we've built these sort of first year, like I will step back and call them, my slides, like first year consultant slides. Like, strangely, they were the hardest ones to build when I was building this last year. But basically thinking that we have these sort of like three overlapping and compounding waves of thinking about decarbonization. You know, the first is looking at a world mostly of renewable energy, driven mostly by subsidy, mostly in a specific set of markets, and mostly with limited applications. Wind and solar, bioenergy to an extent, carbon markets in Europe. The kinds of people that did this were themselves small teams, small companies, specialized groups. Every kind of instrument behind them was fairly bespoke, in particular on the financing. Like, you had just a couple of people working on this thing, or a small PE fund that was doing it. And as this sort of becomes a victim of its own success, you sort of have to widen the frame to thinking about more activity in decarbonization. And that's energy transition, which comes next and includes everything that went before, but also includes electrified transport and battery energy storage, the early intimations of thinking about decarbonizing heat. And it has a bigger frame. It involves bigger companies. The groups within a company working on it are themselves bigger. They're doing everything they went before in renewable energy. That doesn't go away. But the strategic frame adds this extra layer of capability. And it also, if we think about it as an abstraction layer within the company, has moved itself up from special situations group to maybe strategic planning within a big company. There's an SVP for X. You know, it might report to the CFO or the chief strategist. It's definitely something that the CEO is aware of on more than a boardroom quarterly meeting periodicity. And that's sort of where we are right now. We're talking a lot more about the next one, which is net zero. And obviously it's everything that went before, but it's now doing the remaining 90% of decarbonizing electricity and sales of transport on the ground, but then also shipping, rail, if we can do it, aviation, if we can do it, heavy duty transport on the surface, class 8 trucks and whatnot. It's also going after industry. So it's going after making steel, cement, aluminum. It's going after food and agriculture, things that don't sort of fall within that same industrial framework, but are very, very essential. It involves attacking things like methane and CFCs, not just carbon dioxide. And it leaves the company no out. Like, if you're going to say that you have a net zero approach, like you can't cheat it. There's no way to go in and say, well, I did 90% net zero and 10% will be just sort of abstracted away, or it's somebody else's problem. You also talk about managing carbon, so, you know, removing it from the atmosphere and finding a geologic home for it, or using it in some meaningful way and that's economically viable. And it seems like the logical next step, because it is, from a sort of like climate strategy perspective, it is the next step, except that it's extremely difficult to do. And companies, when they make these commitments, can kick them out so far, to be sort of blunt about it, that whatever decision maker
in the future
made that decision is not going to have to do it. Right? Like, it's out, it's beyond their frame. If I'm an executive in his or her late 50s to early 60s, and I say, this company that I am a professional steward of is going to hit net zero by 2050. That will occur when I'm either in my late 80s or potentially my early 90s. And I would hope that I'm no longer running that company by that point. And I think it's important for us to remember that, like, this is, it's both evolutionary rhetorically and in terms of how companies, I think, arrange their own thinking, but it is absolutely revolutionary in what it entails. And so my sort of goal in proposing this is to help people consciously think through, okay, well, what does that actually mean? It was easy to say, it's difficult to do. In retrospect, the prior waves we've gone through were, at the time, they were hard to say, and they ended up being easier than people thought to some extent. This stuff is easy to say, and it's going to be very, very hard to do. And the other reason I posit that is that because, like, more than 80% of global GDP, of global emissions, and of global energy are covered by one of these targets already. And many of the key industries have got 40 to 70% of their production today, one way or another, assigned to get themselves to net zero by the middle of the century. And like, this is hard. This is a lot harder than just saying, well, I'll convert every warehouse to being on a virtual PPA, power purchase agreement, for solar, and whoopee ding, I'm done. And now I've, like, you know, I've hit my energy transition target for my warehouses, or I've shifted all of my light duty vehicles to EVs over the course of a decade. Great. That's a little bit easier than saying, like, I'm going to decarbonize cement production or steel production, things like that. And there's exciting activity happening. But, you know, one of the things that I focused on in the back third of my presentation was, how are you going to think about this as a company besides just, like, it's an opportunistic investment? Like, who do you partner with? Who do you acquire? What do you get rid of? Where's your competitive advantage going to lie? How do you think about the fact that, you know, you could be in an energy transition process in a big company and it has left completely untouched 90% of your property, plant, equipment? Like, if you're actually going to decarbonize all power generation, what are you going to do with all of your old stuff? and part of that for me is to be constructive. I'm of the mind that a lot of these things will be reused. I called it maybe my most abstract bit of writing ever, the ship of Theseus argument, that, like, the value of a brownfield asset somewhere is sort of Schrodingerian in the near term. Like, it's either a giant environmental liability, billions of dollars to clean up, or it has multiple hundreds of millions of dollars worth of transmission connection, construction, lay down, feed, water. You don't need to worry, this is very cynical, but you don't need to worry about precise on-site disturbance of soil if you're not covering the entire area with something new or remediating the entire area. You know, and what is the value of the asset, back to the ship of Theseus, is if you rebuild this entire thing, right, you've rebuilt every rivet of it, what is it? Is it still an energy asset? Is it a liability? What are you going to put into this site that used to have a subcritical coal plant? Is it going to be full of batteries? Is it going to be a new demand center where you stuff it full of electrolyzers and you draw from a decarbonized grid? Is it going to host small modular reactors? Or question mark, like, how are people going to start to view this and the associated human capital that goes with them, especially locationally specific human capital, into these new places? How are we going to consider what people are capable of doing with all of these assets? So this is very hand wavy, I will be the first to say, but I think it's useful, hopefully, after arriving at it on the back end of, like, 120 very evidentiary slides, that these are the kind of questions that I hope people are asking of themselves.
And so now, the two questions that everybody gets asked. The first one is, have you got anything you want to plug? And we're going to put links to a load of your content in the show notes. And I'll just say to anybody who's listening, check Nat out on Twitter's a great place to find him. But Nat, anything that you're working on that you want to talk about or you want to plug? Here's your chance.
I'll be working on the next one of these decks as soon as I get the chance. Like, I have a sort of running file of things that I feel like I need to be visualizing and putting into the next framework. I'm practically salivating because the statistical review, the erstwhile BP statistical review, was published mere minutes before we started recording. So I cannot wait to dig in and find out what's happening in the world and the world's energy stocks and flows. I think that that's the main one, is like, look for this one, you know, early next year, as soon as I get time to settle into it. But I really need the time. I've got dozens of things that need building. I've already built another 50 slides to go follow on last year's. And I'm just trying to figure out what the story is. It's a very salutary process. It's very iterative. I wouldn't call it easy, but it's rewarding.
And I've got to say, big fan of the logo. The colors in the logo match the colors in the slide every time. Love that.
I put a lot of work into that. You know, it was actually part of my budget when I sort of stepped out to do these things independently, was to hire a very good designer. If you want to pitch, I will pitch Sabrina Yen of Cassava Studios, who did my colorways, built the logo, helped me visualize what was there. And honestly, that in and of itself was a very important part of the process for me. These are things that are not within one's own capability to determine when you work for a very large corporation, but are if you're independent. And it helps it be memorable. It helps it be mine. And I think carrying through lines of all this stuff across various visuals is useful. To me, it was a fun part of the process.
And now I want to ask you the most exciting question, really. And I'm really interested to know what you have to say about this. What's your contrarian view? What's the thing that you believe, with all of this macro knowledge that you have and all the experience, you know, what do you believe that perhaps not everybody else does about the world of energy?
I think that the changes to come will be faster than the changes to date. That's my contrarian view, is that actually the last exponent, if you will, to get from 10% to 100% decarbonization is actually going to be the one that moves the fastest rather than the slowest. And that is very contrarian, I think, because this gets very much into a sort of stocks and flows question. You know, there's all this that we do right now. There's all this we built to run our current system. It's huge. And in fact, it's all at its peaks. We're, you know, basically all-time peaks in emissions and therefore, by definition, in consumption of the things that provide those emissions. But, you know, the trajectories of the instruments of change are as fast as they've ever been, if not faster, with much greater scale. And the fact that the Overton window now includes the deepest possible decarbonization or even net zero as the way that companies need to think and the way that individuals can align their own thinking is extremely exciting. So that's my contrarian view, is that it'll move faster. I'm not saying it's going to be easier, but that it'll move faster now than it has been moving to date. It's very difficult when you have an extremely high embedded base and you have a very low level of exponential growth. We're starting to see them kind of come into the same frame where people pay attention to them, you know. The first trillion is the hardest, so to speak. But now, watching the change to come, I think that I'm very hopeful that people want to attack the most difficult problems at every level, from the entrepreneurial right up to the multinational company. I think that governments themselves are pretty committed to helping support these paths along the way. That's things like, you know, the IRA and Fit for 50 in Europe, and that. If we look at the generation below us, we're both fathers. I think that our respective children's expectations will be entirely around a world where, by the time they're our age, there are hopefully no net emissions.
Incredible. Nat, we're going to leave it there. I want to say a massive thank you for coming on. I know you've got plenty going on, moving continent and all of the stuff you're working on is at the same time.
Yep.
But it really has been a privilege. For anybody who's listening, do read the show notes, go to all the links, check out Nat on all mediums. You'll learn a ton. We certainly do. And remember, hit like, subscribe, and all the good buttons. It means the world to us. Thanks, Nat. See you next time.
Thanks, Q.